to any other in a day, and with our huge global population, bigger aircraft, and low-cost airfares, more people are travelling more frequently and further than ever before. An interesting personal study by David Bradley of the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine in the late 1980s conveniently makes the point. He plotted the lifetime travel patterns of four male generations in his family, his great-grandfather, grandfather, father, and himself, and showed that the spatial range increased tenfold with each generation, his own being 1,000 times that of his great-grandfather. Microbes were not slow to exploit this new opportunity. With millions of people taking to the air every year, the risk of transporting microbes, be they inside a human, animal, or insect, increased dramatically. We have seen many examples in previous chapters. West Nile fever virus probably jetted into the US from the Middle East inside a stowaway mosquito. HIV arrived in the US inside tourists from Haiti and then city-hopped throughout the US and Europe. And SARS made the leap from Hong Kong to five other countries inside human incubators. Even traditionally, tropical infections are now jet-setting around the world. In 1983, the landlord of a village pub 12 miles from Gatwick Airport near London suddenly collapsed with malaria, and the microbe also infected an unfortunate motorcyclist who happened to pass through the village at the time. And more recently, several people living near Geneva Airport caught malaria without ever leaving Switzerland when parasite-laden mosquitoes hitched a ride in a plane from the tropics. Antibiotic resistance. In 1945, Sir Alexander Fleming predicted that microbes would evolve antibiotic resistance, pointing out in his Nobel Prize speech that it is not difficult to make microbes resistant to penicillin in the laboratory by exposing them to concentrations not sufficient to kill them, and the same thing has occasionally happened in the body. At the time, hardly anyone heeded his warning, perhaps because as soon as penicillin hit the market, scientists set to work uncovering more natural antibiotics, while chemists tinkered with the natural molecules to make new active derivatives. So with literally hundreds of wonder drugs to choose from, few doctors thought very seriously about microbe resistance. 60 years later, we have a huge global problem. Increasing numbers of microbes are acquiring resistance to multiple drugs. The natural source of antibiotics has virtually run dry, and there are few new drugs in the pipeline. How have we reached this crisis situation? Most of our antimicrobial drugs, such as penicillin, are antibiotics, natural chemicals produced by bacteria and fungi to ward off other microbes. The word antibiotic, meaning against life, was coined to describe their power to kill microbes by shutting down essential functions. The beauty of this from the human point of view is that antibiotics only target microbes, leaving our own cells unharmed. Penicillin works by blocking the transpeptidase enzymes that are essential for building a bacterium's tough outer wall. So when bacteria try to grow in the presence of penicillin, their cells rupture and die. But with their rapid reproduction rate, bacteria are expert at adapting by natural selection. A chance genetic change that confers resistance to a drug will give an individual microbe such a competitive edge that within hours its offspring, all similarly resistant, will outstrip the competitors and dominate the population. But many bacteria don't have to wait to inherit a resistance gene. They can pick it up from others by gene swapping, a process that is rife among bacterial communities. Since many antibiotic-resistant genes are extrachromosomal, carried either by plasmids or other transposable elements, they are highly mobile. So multidrug resistance is not only spread by the rapid growth of resistant bacterial clones, but also by swapping of the offending genes. In recent years, our use of antibiotics has escalated, some legitimate and some irresponsible and inappropriate, and microbes have been quietly cashing in on the situation. New and complex surgical procedures often require antibiotic cover to give the patients the best chance of survival, while at the other end of the scale, antibiotics are regularly prescribed for minor ailments, like throat infections that are usually caused by viruses, and so are unlikely to benefit. Then, most of us are happy to take medicines while we are ill, but once we feel better, it is tempting not to complete the course. This partial treatment is bound to generate antibiotic resistance when the drug kills the most sensitive microbes first, leaving the resistant ones to grow unimpeded. The problem is compounded by over-the-counter antibiotics, with people free to choose the type of antibiotic and length of treatment. No wonder the highest levels of multidrug-resistant microbes are found in countries with easiest access to the drugs. The community microbe, Streptococcus pneumoniae, generally known as pneumococcus, is a case in point. It heads the list of bacterial infections and deaths worldwide, causing bronchitis, ear and sinus infections, as well as life-threatening pneumonia, meningitis, and septicemia. For years, pneumococcus was successfully killed by penicillin, but emerging penicillin resistance is now a worldwide problem. While the incidence of resistance has risen from 5% to 35% in 20 years in the US, where antibiotics are freely available, it has remained at around 5% in the UK. But scientists have fought back with a new pneumococcal vaccine, which was used for the first time in the US in 2000. This reduced childhood infections, and interestingly, the consequent reduction in antibiotic use reversed the rising tide of resistant microbes by removing their selective advantage. Drug resistance is also potentiated by the enormous overuse of antibiotics in agriculture. Farmed animals consume over half the world's antibiotics. These are used not just to treat a sick animal, but the whole herd gets a dose to prevent the microbe spreading. Worse still, by some mysterious means, low-dose antibiotics promote the growth of farmed animals, so they may be added to animal feed. And although some countries have now banned this practice, in others, herds still receive lifelong treatment. This is a recipe for emerging resistant microbes, and indeed, a multidrug-resistant strain of the zoonotic microbe, Salmonella enterica typhimurium, that causes diarrheal disease in millions of people every year, has already emerged in animals and spread to humans. Staphylococcus aureus lives harmlessly in the noses of many healthy people, but causes havoc when let loose in hospital surgical wards and intensive care units. It can live for months in bedclothes or dust and is often inadvertently carried from one patient to another by hospital staff. It targets the most debilitated patients, infecting their lungs, surgical wounds, and catheter sites, and from there it can invade the blood to cause a highly dangerous septicemia. The microbe's first maneuver in the fight against antibiotics was to produce lactamase, an enzyme that destroys the penicillin molecule. When this penicillin-resistant Staph aureus became a problem, doctors switched to using one of its semi-synthetic derivatives, methicillin. But the bacteria then produced a new type of transpeptidase that could not be blocked by either penicillin or methicillin. So to treat this methicillin-resistant Staph aureus, MRSA, doctors turned to vancomycin, a drug that disrupts the bacterial cell wall by a different route. Known as the antibiotic of last resort, This worked for 30 years, but in 2002 the microbe struck back and vancomycin-resistant MRSA emerged in the US. Its global spread is now a real possibility. And so, while the arms race continues, MRSA plagues our hospitals, closing wards and cancelling operating lists. In the UK, MRSA levels rose dramatically in the mid to late 1990s, with the additional cost to the health service of £1 billion annually. But contrary to popular belief, doctors still have one or two antibiotics up their sleeves to treat MRSA, and there are a few new drugs coming online. Also, MRSA can be controlled in other ways. Hospitals in Denmark, Sweden, and Holland have conquered the microbe by scrupulous hand-washing and strict patient isolation, but this requires more expensive isolation facilities than many countries can afford. MRSA is by no means the only superbug. On a worldwide scale, multidrug-resistant TB and malaria are much more serious problems, and now drug-resistant HIV is raising its ugly head. Although caused by completely unrelated microbes using quite different transmission routes, these three persistent microbes are inextricably linked. All three target sub-Saharan Africa, where HIV potentiates the effect of the other two, particularly reactivating quiescent TB. The scale of the problem posed by each microbe is enormous, and the only answer is cheap and effective vaccination. But with no vaccines yet available for HIV or malaria, and the traditional BCG vaccine for TB only partially effective, control programs rely heavily on drug treatments, which are now jeopardized by microbe resistance. Antibiotics are not effective against viruses, so the emergence of HIV in the 1980s prompted pharmaceutical companies to develop antiviral drugs, and with new molecular know-how for identifying drug targets, the field blossomed. In 1990, there were only four on the market. 15 years later, we have over 40, most of which are aimed at HIV. These drugs revolutionized the management of HIV infection in the West, and now, with cheaper drugs available from the pharmaceutical companies and generic manufacture, HAART, is being slowly rolled out in developing nations. But still, we cannot eliminate the virus or cure the sufferers. These drugs simply buy time until eventually patients run out of treatment options, and then the microbe can grow unimpeded. There are all sorts of reasons why people living with HIV do not always take their drugs regularly. For one thing, it is a lifelong commitment and often involves many different tablets taken several times a day. Also, the drugs may produce unpleasant side effects, and when these are compounded with the symptoms of HIV infection, particularly in its late stages, the drugs are often not tolerated. With this non-compliance, it is no wonder that HIV, like other microbes, is evolving drug resistance. Doctors used to think that resistant strains were weaker and less likely to be transmitted than their non-mutated counterparts, but a recent report describing a promiscuous gay man in New York who was infected with a highly virulent HIV strain suggests otherwise. Labeled AIDS superbug by the press, the virus is resistant to three of the four classes of anti-HIV drugs and is almost impossible to treat effectively. Worse still, his disease progressed exceedingly rapidly, so that 20 months into the infection, the man's immunity was as low as that typically seen 10 years from the start. It remains to be seen whether this superbug is on the increase, but this case stresses the importance of prevention strategies as well as treatment. Clearly, vaccine development is top priority in the battle against HIV, but although scientists have tested products that stimulate either antibody or killer T-cell responses, neither can protect against the virus. Since HIV can outstrip natural immunity by mutating rapidly, maybe a conventional vaccine will not succeed. Other strategies, like producing a therapeutic vaccine to boost immunity and enable virus carriers to remain symptom-free, are being tested, but no one is optimistic that a vaccine will be available in the next 5 years. In the meantime, we must fight the virus without a vaccine by attacking it on all fronts. If we can interrupt its chain of infection and reduce R0 to less than 1, then we will eventually win. But to have any chance of this, we need to ramp up all the public health measures, education programs targeted at high-risk groups, needle exchange facilities for IV drug users, and free condom distribution. In Africa, empowerment of women to take control of their lives is an imperative if the virus is to be halted, and to this end, microbicidal vaginal creams are being developed, but to date none has proved protective. M. tuberculosis evolved resistance to individual anti-TB drugs soon after drug treatment began in the 1950s, but it was so successfully controlled by multi-drug treatment regimens that some confidently predicted global elimination of TB. But this was not to be. M. tuberculosis began to get the upper hand in the 1970s. And by the early 1990s, it was clear that we had a global emergency. The world was first alerted to this rapidly growing pandemic by a completely unexpected outbreak of TB in New York. In 1968, the mayor of New York was planning to clear TB from the city, but just 10 years later, it was on the brink of an epidemic. Starting from familiar territory in the deprived inner-city districts of Central Harlem and Lower East Side, the microbe crept out to surrounding areas, eventually colonizing all the New York health districts, with the sole exception of the very wealthiest. The epidemic peaked in 1992, when the worst affected areas reported well over 100 new cases per square mile. It soon became apparent that this alarming resurgence of TB was a worldwide phenomenon caused by a combination of increasing poverty and homelessness, accompanying the cutbacks in the public health expenditure in U.S. cities in the 1980s, together with HIV-induced immunosuppression reactivating quiescent TB and drug resistance. Now, despite BCG being the most widely used vaccine in the world, an estimated 2 billion people are infected with M. tuberculosis, one-third of the world's population. Thankfully, most of these infections are inactive, but worldwide, 8 million people have active TB and 2 million die of it every year. Not surprisingly, over 95% of the problem is in the developing world, with sub-Saharan Africa being the worst affected. Here, at least 11 million people have the lethal combination of TB and HIV, and since TB generally affects adults in their most productive years of life, the microbe has an enormous economic impact. Unlike MRSA, M. tuberculosis cannot pick up resistance genes from other microbes, so it relies on spontaneous mutations to outwit the drugs. And since mutations are rare, the double mutation it needs to develop multi-drug resistance can realistically only have arisen from drug misuse. Poor supervision and compliance, inconsistent prescribing, erratic drug supply, and unregulated over-the-counter drug sales have all played their part, and now mutant multidrug-resistant strains of TB, MDR, TB, account for around 10% of new cases worldwide. Worst hit are Russia and the former Soviet Union states due to the breakdown of healthcare services during the political upheavals of the 1990s and sub-Saharan Africa with its enormous HIV problem. The only solution we have is longer treatment regimens with more toxic drugs, but at 200 times the price of the conventional treatment, they are just not available where they are most needed. The fight against the TB pandemic began with the WHO directly observed therapy, short course, DOTS, program in the 1990s. By ensuring patients were seen by medical staff and had a regular supply of free drugs, this aimed to give sufferers proper treatment, allowing the microbe no chance to develop resistance. The program worked well for drug-sensitive TB, but most cases of MDR-TB do not respond. Now the problem in South Africa seems to be spiraling out of control. Poor treatment of MDR-TB has already led to the emergence of even more drug-resistant XDR-TB, extensively drug-resistant TB. And if nothing is done to stop this escalation, we will soon have an epidemic of completely drug-resistant TB on our hands. And with new drugs and more effective vaccines, just a distant dream, this will be disastrous. The early 20th century saw the malaria parasite banished from the US and most of Europe, and in the 1950s and 1960s, WHO launched a global eradication program. Using the insecticide DDT, dichlorodiphenyl trichloroethane, to kill off the mosquito vector, and chloroquine, to treat sufferers, the scheme made some significant inroads, particularly in South America, India, Sri Lanka and the former Soviet Union, although less effort was made to control the microbe that was rampant in sub-Saharan Africa. But the global program soon ran into problems. It was vastly expensive. People resented the repeated insecticide spraying of their homes, and when DDT-resistant mosquitoes emerged, it was the final straw. For several decades, while other killers were being tackled successfully, the malaria parasite was allowed to run riot. The world malaria burden remained unchanged until the beginning of the 21st century, when deaths from malaria began to rise. The parasite now infects around 500 million people in 103 countries every year and kills 1 million, one death every 30 seconds. The casualties are mostly children in sub-Saharan Africa, where 90% of the world malaria burden falls. In the worst affected countries, one in every four children die before the age of 5 years. In this recent resurgence, the malaria parasite has benefited from wars, civil unrest, and weakened healthcare services. Changes in the environment and climate have brought malaria-carrying mosquitoes to new areas, while massive population growth has facilitated parasite spread. Insecticide resistance also remains a problem. But the major factor in this evolving disaster is the emergence of drug-resistant parasites. Chloroquine was once the mainstay of malaria treatment in sub-Saharan Africa, but now resistant microbes are widespread and doctors working in the killing fields have nothing else. They are powerless to treat the disease. Despite the gloomy figures and forecasts, there are reasons for optimism in our battle against malaria. To have any effect, we need to break the microbe's transmission cycle, and there are several new tools in the pipeline which will help. Satellite imagery can map malaria hotspots in Africa. A mutant form of A. gambiae, which cannot transmit malaria, is being prepared for release, and potential vaccines are in clinical trials. But scientific advances are only part of the answer to the conquest of malaria in Africa. Insecticide-impregnated bed nets, cheap and effective against malaria are used by less than 2% of African children, and new anti-malaria drugs extracted from the herb ginkgo, Artemisia annua, or sweet wormwood, an ancient Chinese anti-fever herbal remedy, are available in Southeast Asia to treat chloroquine-resistant disease, but not in most of Africa. What is needed to fight this most persistent of parasites is money. An estimated $5 billion annually for the foreseeable future, not only to fund essential prevention and treatment programs in Africa, but also to provide local people with the education and the infrastructure to help themselves. A tall order? Yes, but if neglected, then the combination of drug resistance and spread to new areas aided by global warming will cause malaria cases to rocket. Millions more lives will be lost. All the exciting new scientific advances from the Malaria Genome Project will go to waste. Africa will not attain its economic potential, and the microbe will triumph. Flu. Ever since the Chinese domesticated waterfowl and pigs, some 9,500 years ago, new strains of flu have probably jumped to humans, causing epidemics and more recently pandemics. Unlike most other microbes that jumped species all those years ago, flu continues to jump at regular intervals, and to date, modern science has had little impact on its exploits. Human-adapted flu viruses can circulate continuously among us, generally keeping a low profile, but causing outbreaks each winter that kill around 250,000 people globally, mostly targeting the elderly and chronically sick. But every now and then, a pandemic strain appears that sweeps round the world, infecting and killing millions. Of the three pandemics in the 20th century, by far the worst was the famous 1918 Spanish flu, which hit as the First World War was ending. Just as in ancient times, the pandemic enveloped an unsuspecting world like a great tidal wave, infecting half the world's population and leaving 20 to 50 million dead in its wake. People had no idea where it came from, what caused it, or how to combat it. Now, less than 100 years later, we know the answers and are in a position for the first time to watch a possible new pandemic unfold. After an attack of flu, we are protected from further infection, mostly by antibodies directed against H, hemagglutinin, and N, neuraminidase, proteins on the surface of the virus particle. So after an epidemic, when most people are immune, the virus loses its power. But unlike other viruses that cause acute infections, the flu virus fights back by changing its H and N genes so that it can dodge our immune system and reinfect. There are 15 different H genes and 9 N genes, and flu virus strains are named by their particular combination. The original Spanish flu was caused by H1N1 virus, which was replaced by H2N2 in 1957. Asian flu, and in 1968, H3N2, Hong Kong flu, emerged. Then in 1977, H1N1, Spanish flu, reappeared. Domestic and wild birds are the natural reservoir for flu viruses, carrying a whole variety of different strains in their guts as a silent infection, and excreting them in their droppings. And because the virus has a segmented genome with 8 separate genes, those from different strains sometimes get mixed and matched to create new strains. This happens when 2 different strains of flu virus infect the same cell, and hybrid viruses emerge containing an assorted mixture of genes from the 2 parent viruses. Bird flu viruses usually lack the receptor binding protein needed to infect human cells, but some domestic animals, like pigs and horses, are susceptible to both bird and human strains. So gene swapping between human and bird strains often occurs in pigs or horses, causing a major genetic change in the virus makeup called an antigenic shift. Occasionally, after this mixing, a new virus strain emerges that can infect and spread in humans, and as the population is completely naive to this new strain, it can spark a pandemic. After a flu pandemic, the same virus strain generally remains in the community for a while, and as it circulates, it slowly accumulates mutations. This is called antigenic drift, and when the virus has changed sufficiently to be unrecognizable to our immune systems, then it will be able to infect again and cause a new epidemic. H5N1 bird flu is not new. It was first recognized in chickens in Scotland in 1959 and turned up next on Southeast Asian chicken farms in the 1990s. At this stage, it only caused a mild disease in poultry, but sometime in the mid-1990s, it mutated into a highly virulent strain that killed virtually all infected chickens in 48 hours. This strain first jumped to humans in Hong Kong in 1997, when it infected 18 people, killing 6 of them. In an attempt to prevent its spread, the authorities ordered the slaughter of millions of chickens, which seemed to do the trick, since all went quiet for a while. But in 2003, the virus resurfaced in Hong Kong, Vietnam, and Thailand. Now we have a wholesale bird flu pandemic affecting poultry flocks in at least 18 countries. So far, it has only attacked humans who handle infected birds and is not yet adapted for transmission between humans, but the alarming fact is that it has killed over half the people it has infected. To try to figure out why H5N1 is such an efficient killer, scientists have turned to the H1N1 flu strain that killed around 2.5% of those it infected during the 1918 pandemic. They have ingeniously reconstructed this virus from stored post-mortem lung material from a U.S. serviceman who died in the pandemic, and also from an Alaskan flu victim whose body was preserved by being buried in the permafrost for nearly 100 years. In the classical scenario outlined above, bird flu strains swap genes with human strains before they can infect humans efficiently, and this genetic mixing often takes place in domestic pigs. Scientists working on the lethal 1918 H1N1 strain still don't know where it came from, and some even speculate that it jumped straight from birds to humans, bypassing any intermediate host. They then found that compared to a non-pandemic flu strain, it had undergone 10 mutations that allowed it to infect and grow very efficiently in human cells. They pinpointed one particular mutation in its NS1 gene that prevents infected cells from producing a cytokine called interferon, one of the body's first lines of defense against viruses. So immediately the virus is one step ahead, multiplying rapidly in the lungs and producing up to an amazing 39,000 times more virus than its non-mutated relatives. The body reacts to this rampant infection with a massive and inappropriate inflammatory response called a cytokine storm, and the unfortunate victim literally drowns as the air sacs of their lungs fill with blood and fluid. H5N1 has already acquired this particular NS1 mutation, and several of the others found in pandemic H1N1, which is why it is so lethal. All it needs now is to acquire mutations that help it infect and transfer between humans more easily, so it is probably only a matter of time before it causes a human pandemic. It is difficult to prepare for a possible pandemic sometime in the future without knowing the exact genetic makeup of the culprit virus. Although we have antiviral drugs that can combat the flu strains presently circulating, it is by no means certain that they will help to control a new strain. Similarly, vaccines made to prevent today's H5N1 may not protect against a mutated variant. So we are on a knife edge between, on the one hand, waiting to discover the exact molecular makeup of the future pandemic strain and being too late to respond, and on the other, making early preparations that may, in the event, prove unnecessary or ineffective. At this stage, it is imperative to monitor this rapidly evolving pathogen in both animals and humans, and WHO have a network of laboratories worldwide continually monitoring human flu strains to produce an appropriate vaccine each year. In collaboration with the World Organization for Animal Health and the United Nations, staff in these laboratories are now monitoring the evolution and spread of H5N1 strains in both birds and humans. Despite uncertainty surrounding a human H5N1 flu pandemic, there is no doubt that we are in the midst of the worst ever recorded flu pandemic in birds. The virus started life as a harmless infection in the intestines of wild birds and jumped to domestic chickens in the 1990s, where modern intensive farming techniques gave it the opportunity to adapt and evolve. When a mutated virus emerged that could infect all the organs of a chicken, it killed rapidly. And now, this virulent strain has not only crossed back into wildfowl, but has increased its host range to include other birds, crows, pigeons, falcons, buzzards, and even some mammals, such as cats. Thousands of wild birds are dying of the infection, and there are real fears for species already endangered by loss of habitat, particularly if they have a limited geographical range. Qinghai Lake in north-central China lies at the crossroads of several bird migration pathways, and every year, bar-headed geese are among those that drop in for a well-deserved rest after their flight over the Himalayas from India. For 6,000 of these geese that arrived in 2005, it was their last journey. They died of H5N1 beside the lake, a loss of a tenth of the world's population. If a virus that kills so rapidly relied on migrating birds for its dissemination, it would not get far, and the pandemic would die out. But now there is evidence that this virus, so lethal to chickens and other birds, has evolved to be harmless in ducks. Once infected, they remain healthy and just shed the virus in their droppings for a week or two, quite long enough to carry it on their migration and pass it on to other susceptible birds. In theory, silently infected ducks could spread the virulent virus round and round the globe, but in practice, we really don't know what the future holds. With a virus so prone to mutation, anything could happen. So what can we do to stop it causing further damage to our beleaguered wildlife? It is not possible to kill all infected wild birds or vaccinate susceptible ones, but we can try to prevent infection in poultry flocks with vaccination. This would at least limit opportunities for the virus to evolve, hopefully save the livelihood of many poor smallholders and perhaps prevent further passage to humans. We have seen in this chapter how modern technology has intervened to improve the lot of the afflicted as microbes emerge, re-emerge, and evolve in the 21st century. But we are still left with many killer microbes on the loose for which we have not found solutions. Microbes have been quick to exploit our global society, but unfortunately, we have not yet come up with global solutions to control them. Conclusion. Living together. Microbes were the first life forms to evolve on planet Earth, and now there are more of them than any other organisms, inhabiting every conceivable niche, including the bodies of other species. We, relative newcomers to the planet, emerge from the safe environment of our mother's womb, pristine, untouched by infectious microbes, but within hours our bodies are colonized by swarms of them, all intent on living off this new food source. From then on, there is no getting away from them. They surround us, living on our skin and inside our bodies in their millions. The vast majority of these microbes are either necessary for our existence or completely harmless. Only a few live as parasites, dining on our tissues and in so doing cause disease. Throughout our history, pathogenic microbes have exploited our cultural changes, turning each one to their own advantage. So while we evolved from hunter-gatherer to modern city-dweller, microbes kept us company. At each new step, microbes were ready to pounce, usually jumping from their natural animal host and then evolving with us, generally to mutual benefit. The increasing complexity of our social structures accentuated inequalities until the divide between the rich and poor, the have and have not, and the vulnerable and protected became embedded in our culture. Consequently, fueled by overcrowded, unhygienic living conditions and spread by travelers, opportunistic microbes caused devastating epidemics which we have only recently learnt to control. With public health measures to inhibit their spread, vaccines to deny them access to our bodies, and antimicrobial drugs to kill them off, global deaths from infectious disease finally began to fall in the early 1900s. But despite all our efforts, microbes are still a major killer, accounting for 17 million deaths a year, around a third of all deaths worldwide. And as HIV took hold in the 1980s, the death rate from infections rose again, doubling between 1980 and 2000. With an increasing number of new microbes emerging, microbe drug resistance on the increase, and the threat of bioterrorism, we could be heading for a crisis. Louis Pasteur was the first to point out that the microbe is nothing, the terrain everything. We have always been part of microbes' terrain, but by taking control of Earth, we have invaded their space and disrupted their natural cycles, and now we are suffering the consequences. So how can we protect ourselves from their devastating effects in the 21st century? The elimination of the smallpox virus was a major triumph in our fight against killer microbes, saving millions of lives. And now, measles and polio viruses are well on their way to extinction. But global elimination is not an achievable or even desirable goal for most pathogenic microbes. Similarly, the invention of a superdrug, the so-called gorillacillin, that would protect against a wide range of bacteria, is just a pipe dream. And even if its production was feasible, this sledgehammer approach would kill indiscriminately, wiping out the good microbes along with the bad. As free-living organisms, many bacteria form part of mutually dependent colonies, which we disrupt to our peril. Those in our gut, for example, generally help to keep us healthy, but may cause nasty infections if given the chance to invade our tissues. A short course of oral antibiotics is enough to disturb their microenvironment by killing off most of the susceptible ones, and this clear-out often induces diarrhea and on occasions thrush by allowing the normally harmless fungus, Candida albicans, to flourish. Our slow rate of evolution is no match for the diversity and rapid adaptability of microbes, so we must accept that in the short term at least, they will constantly outsmart us. Indeed, having spent millions of years counteracting the very microbial products from which most of our antibiotics are derived, it is a fair bet that microbes will find ways of resisting any new products we throw at them. The best defense we have against microbes is our brains, which can surely work out how to live in harmony with the microbes we know and find non-disruptive ways of combating those that emerge in the future. Fortunately, the genome era is upon us, and our knowledge of microbes has escalated, vastly improving our understanding and ability to counteract them. Just look at the speed at which new scientific facts emerged during the SARS epidemic. The culprit coronavirus was isolated within weeks, and its genome sequence mapped less than a month later. Almost immediately, tests became available to diagnose suspected cases, trace contacts, and identify the probable animal host, and work is now progressing fast towards a vaccine. Just a decade ago, all this would have taken years to achieve. So how does the genome revolution help in our attempt to live in harmony with microbes? The first pathogenic human virus to be completely sequenced was the Epstein-Barr virus in 1984, followed by the first bacterial sequence, Haemophilus influenzae, in 1995. Now, several thousands of bacterial and viral sequences are known, and the comparatively huge malaria parasite genome sequence has just been completed. This provides a seemingly limitless fund of information which can surely be used to improve health globally. As we have seen in earlier chapters, the sequence of microbe genes alone can tell us about their origin and evolution as they radiated out from their source, and can uncover the molecular details of their parasitic lifestyle. But with the whole human genome sequence, comprising around 25,000 genes at our fingertips, we can now look at the ways microbes interact with their human host at the molecular level. This is revealing the secrets of our genetic susceptibility and resistance to microbes, identifying drug targets, and opening up a range of exciting new vaccine possibilities. Vaccination was the first successful form of immunotherapy, the process of harnessing the immune system to control microbes, and everyone agrees that it is still the best way forward. Indeed, there is clear evidence that vaccines can reduce the rising tide of antibiotic resistance. As we saw in Chapter 8, the incidence of antibiotic-resistant pneumococcus in the U.S. rose from 5% to 35% over 20 years. But when a pneumococcal vaccine was introduced in 2000, fewer antibiotics were needed, the selection pressure was removed, and the incidence of resistance fell. Traditional vaccines are made from killed or weakened microbes that induce immunity without disease. But as we have seen with HIV, this approach does not always work, particularly if the body's immune system is suppressed by infection or disease. So, now scientists are devising new and sophisticated types of immunotherapy as safe, non-invasive, natural treatments for infections. Antibodies are a key part of the body's defense against invading microbes, particularly bacteria. Now, designer antibodies directed against individual microbes can be made in the laboratory and used to neutralize an invading microbe. Similarly, killer T cells, our main defense against viruses, are being harvested from healthy people and used to treat infections in people with suppressed immunity, such as transplant recipients and cancer patients. Hopefully, in the future, immunotherapy will be widely available to complement the more traditional ways of combating infections. We have seen how antibiotic resistance genes and emerging microbes, such as HIV and SARS, jetted round the world with amazing speed, and with our present propensity for international travel, other microbes will certainly follow in their footsteps. Wherever a new microbe emerges in the future, it cannot be regarded as just a local problem. In deciding to hush up the SARS outbreak in Guangdong province in 2002, the Chinese government gave the virus a head start and allowed it to spread globally. And while medical personnel around the world struggled with this previously unknown disease, Chinese doctors already had successful protocols for its containment that could have saved many lives. But China is not alone in preferring secrecy. When a middle-aged couple from New Mexico turned up in New York with bubonic plague in 2002, probably caught from a wood rat lurking in their backyard, the outside world only got to hear of it after the victims were well on their way to recovery. Perhaps it is understandable that governments wish to avoid the inevitable economic collapse that accompanies the rumor of an epidemic these days, but in our globalized world, this is not acceptable. Only global cooperation can prevent the looming catastrophe of a flu pandemic. Microbes know nothing of countries and do not respect their boundaries. As Anthony Fauci, director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, USA, said when referring to our fight against HIV, "History will judge us as a global community. After all, that is how we have always been seen by our deadly companions." This concludes Deadly Companions by Dorothy H. Crawford, narrated by Jennifer M. Dixon. Copyright 2007 by Dorothy H. Crawford. This unabridged audiobook is published by arrangement with Oxford University Press and was produced in the year 2018 by Tantor Media Incorporated, a division of Recorded Books which holds the copyright thereto. Please visit Tantor.com for more information on our growing library of unabridged audiobooks.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.